Buenas tardes, vamos a comenzar la sesión de Samuel Eklovi. Lo conocen, no vamos a hacer presentaciones, solo a efectos de la grabación. Digo que está haciendo su tesis doctoral en el Grupo Logos, en la Universidad de Barcelona, y también es alguien muy, muy allegado al Grupo de Filosofía de la Pompeu y también de Girona. De hecho, es colaborador ahora en el Grupo de Filosofía de la Pompeu. El paper que nos va a presentar se llama The Metaphysics of Law, Supervenience, Grounding or Neither. Tu tiempo.
Okay, thank you so much for having me here. It's a pleasure and an honor to participate in this event. I work in University of Barcelona and University of Antwerp, and I'm an external collaborator of UPF, Law and Philosophy Research Group. I'm sorry for having sent multiple handouts. The work I'm going to present is very much in progress. And that's partly the reason why I wanted to present it here, because it's a nice venue to have some good feedbacks now that it's still not completed yet. So part of the reason why I had these multiple versions, I hope you have the last one, which is the one which was printed out, is that I started to think about these issues, so supervenience or grounding in law, by trying to understand some remarks made by Mark Greenberg and Gideon Rosen. But then I just decided what I was really interested in was to focus on the subject matter itself rather than on just the remark made by those two authors. So I'm gonna just give my take on it, and in passing I will of course deal with the arguments presented by them. So some legal philosophers have recently started to avail themselves of the grounding idiom in the philosophy of law, and I'm trying to see what this amounts to and why they should do this in the first place. The talk is divided in two parts. In the first one, I'm going to give some a broad overview of the motivations why one might be willing to think that law has anything to do with metaphysics in the first place. And in the second part, I'm going to review some argument for thinking that although it does have to do with metaphysics, it does not have to do with supervenience, but rather with grounding. So is jurisprudence, is any part of general jurisprudence, does any of it concern metaphysics? Well, in a narrow sense, in a narrow conception of what the field of metaphysics is all about, the answer would be no. So if you look at some very orthodox textbook on the subject, you will find debates such as about the universals, or the nature of time, or the nature of concrete things, but not anything about the nature of law. And that's a contingent feature of the discipline. But I take it there is a wider, broader view of the subject that allows for capturing or for understanding something of general jurisprudence as a debate in metaphysics, as a having to do with the question which is metaphysical. So let's see what that might be. So a part of general jurisprudence has to do with the nature of law, and so with the nature of something. And part of what metaphysics is having to do with the nature of things. Thus, we understand what Fine says in the first quote that you can read here. The second branch of metaphysics is concerned with the nature of things without regard to whether they are real. We might ask, for example, whether material things exist in time in the same way as they exist in space. Or we might ask whether fictional characters are generally created by their authors. And these are questions that we can properly consider, even if we decide at the end of the day to adopt a position in which the reality of the external world is rejected in favor of the reality of a purely phenomenal world, or in which fictional characters are dismissed in favor of the literary works or acts by which they are introduced. So here the thought is quite simple. If you are dealing with the philosophical study of the nature of something, you are in a way already doing metaphysics. And you need not be even worrying about the reality of the thing you're worrying about. There is another understanding of metaphysics, which is in a way closely related to this one, which also allows for capturing jurisprudence in terms of metaphysics. And it's the view that's been widely defended by people like Frank Jackson. According to this view, basically metaphysics is concerned with providing an account of some subject matter, it might be the semantic, the mental, the legal, in terms of a more limited set of things. So for instance, he says, I read from the quote, metaphysics is about what there is and what it's like, but it's not concerned with any old shufflings of what there is and what it's like. Metaphysicians try to seek a comprehensive account of some subject matter, the mind, semantic, or most ambitiously, everything, in terms of a limited number of more or less basic notions. Now, the second thing one might wish to ask is, okay, let's grant that the nature of law is a metaphysical problem, but now a further issue comes in, is it a question of ground? And I think there are three broad paths to ground that one might try to pursue to reach this conclusion. So first of all, one might think that debates about the nature of things are closely related to debates about grounding, either because essence or nature is reducible to grounding or vice versa, or because you think that it lies in the nature of things that they stand in grounding relations. And so by discovering the grounding relations that tie together things, you discover the nature of those very things. The second path to ground would be to start with a picture of metaphysics like the one defended by Jackson or Armstrong, and think that this grand project of relating levels of reality might have been achieved by using supervenience, but then conclude that supervenience was not the right notion to be employed in the first place, and conclude that ground is needed for that project to be a viable one. So for instance, we can read in this sense, I think, Schaeffer, in the third quote that I read, Armstrong makes crucial use of the notion of deontological free lunch. Whatever supervenes, or as we can also say, is entailed or necessitated, is not something ontological additional to the subvenient or necessitating entity or entities. What supervenes is no addition to being. But what could this mean? In Quinean terms, whatever supervenes is an addition to being in the only available sense. It is an additional entry into the list of beings. But in Aristotelian terms, and here you should read in grounding terms, there is a straightforward way to understand Armstrong. Whatever is dependent is not fundamental and does no addition to the sparse basis. And here the notion of fundamentality and of dependence are thought to be thought in terms of grounding. The third way one might create a link between this metaphysical study of the legal reality and grounding is through the attempt to make sense of philosophical debates, which without employing grounding would be difficult to be made sense of. So grounding might play here a useful role to clarify what the position in the field are all about and what the subject matter of the debate is in the first place. And so Fiennes, for instance, argues, I want to read this quote, that in order to clarify what is at stake between the three and the four dimensionalist on the nature of material things, one needs grounding. And I think this is the kind of take that I'm gonna focus on today. So I'm gonna deal with the arguments of people who thought that grounding is needed for legal philosophy in order to make sense of the positions held by the positivist and the anti-positivist, because without grounding, that would not be possible. Or at least things would be murkier and more obscure than they are when understood in grounding terms. So it's become quite fashionable to recast the debate between positivism and anti-positivism in grounding terms. You have Marmor in the SEP entry on the nature of law, Stavropoulos does the same in his SEP entry on legal interpretivism, Planck does the same, Shapiro does the same. All these are people who have claimed or assumed that one can recast the debate in grounding terms. But the only two people that, as far as I know, have argued for this are Rosen and Greenberg. And so these are the guys I'm gonna focus on now. So one might think that since the metaphysical project is kind of related to what Jackson and Armstrong have tried to do, so it's an attempt to account for a subject matter and about its nature, one may start off with the thought that supervenience is a good notion to capture these debates. So one way to test whether grounding is needed is to see whether there is not any other notion that can do the job, and supervenience would be the obvious candidate. So in order to show that supervenience cannot do the job, which is what these people are trying to show, one has to prove that when you think of the position in the field as making supervenience claims, these positions boil down to the same OI equivalent, extensional equivalent, at least. So let legal positivism be, so let's try whether, what are the logical connections between the views as understood in supervenience terms. So let legal positivism be the thesis that legal facts supervene on social facts, and let anti-positivism be the view that legal facts supervene on social and moral facts. Now, to prove that supervenience cannot do the job, one has to show that one, that is, legal positivism entails two, and vice versa. So I'm gonna see whether that's the case. That one entails two, I think it's pretty clear due to a feature of supervenience, a kind of explosive feature of it, according to which once you have a supervenience claim, you can arbitrarily enlarge the base. And so if the LF supervene on the SF, it follows that the LF supervene on SF and whatever you like. And so one implies two. So I have a proof on the endnote if you want to go through it or ask things about it afterwards. So the interesting question is whether the converse is also the case. And now it seems to me there is one crucial aspect that needs to be clarified to see whether that's the case. So we can distinguish two possibilities. One is moral facts are contingent. And if that's the case, it seems that the entailment does not go through. So you can assume too, the legal facts supervene on the social and the moral facts, which means that if you fix the social and the moral, you're gonna fix the legal as well. Now, assume also the negation of one. And so assume that the social facts are fixed and the legal facts vary. Now, this possibility, so the negation of one, is not ruled out by two, because the moral facts may have varied if they are contingent. So from the fact that if one keeps the social and the moral, one must keep fixed the legal, it does not follow that if you just keep fixed the social, then you will have to keep fixed the legal. Indeed, this thing is a symptom of a difference between the two views that one can see by comparing two possible worlds. Like, take world one, which is made of legal facts one, social fact one, moral facts one, and the world two, with legal facts two, moral two, social two. Now, characterize these two worlds in the following way. So SF1 is identical, are identical to SF2, but MF1 are different from MF2. Now, the question is, what does the positivist and the antipositivist have to say to describe the legal facts in those under those circumstances? And the legal positivist will have to say that it's necessary that LF1 are identical to LF2 because the social facts are, by assumption, fixed. While the anti-positivism should say that it's possible that the legal facts will vary across these two worlds, because the moral facts have changed. And this is so because there is a difference between the two views. Let's call it the super difference, which is a difference in supervenience. Namely, according to legal positivism, the legal facts supervene on the social facts alone, and according to the anti-positivism, the negation of this claim is true. Now, here comes in Greenberg's point to the effect that supervenience cannot capture the debate and we need grounding. Now, Greenberg says, if the moral facts are necessary, then two entails one, which is true indeed, because if you assume that the moral facts are necessary, that they are going to be fixed in all worlds. And so once you fix the social facts alone, you will have to say, no matter whether you are a positivist or an anti-positivist, that the legal facts are fixed as well, because the moral facts cannot have changed. So under this second assumption, the moral facts are necessary, two entails one, and since we saw before that one entails two, the two views are equivalent. Now, I have two comments on this. The first is that Greenberg does not provide any argument to the conclusion that moral facts are necessary, and to the extent that he has not done that, he has not provided sufficient reasons for us to think that supervenience cannot do the job. And indeed, to make the dispute rest on this assumption would be very risky, because it would risk jeopardizing the debate itself. The second comment is that it does seem intuitive to me that that the ability of the anti-positivist to disagree with the positivist should be independent of such an assumption, because his argument to the effect that the moral facts are relevant to determining the law in a necessary way should be independent of his take on what the moral facts are essentially like. So you should, to some extent, allow different meta-ethical position to be fed into an anti-positivist position. Because that's not the subject matter at the end. No matter how you conceive of the moral, you want to say that the moral essentially determines the legal. And this is not the case if you make Greenberg's assumption. Now, there is a second route for skepticism about supervenience, the one that was initiated by Rosen. So Rosen's point is basically that if you make, beyond the assumptions we already made, a further one, namely that the moral supervenes on the social broadly construed, then both the positivist and the anti-positivist have to say that the legal facts supervene on the social facts broadly construed alone. So one can easily prove this, because if the social facts broadly construed are a superset of the social facts, then the social facts are gonna supervene on the social facts broadly construed. And then by transitivity of supervenience, you will have to conclude that according to the positivist, the legal facts supervene on the social facts broadly construed alone, And of course, if the moral facts supervene on the social facts broadly construed, then by transitivity of supervenience, you will have to say that the anti-positivists has to say that the legal facts supervene on the social facts broadly construed alone. So Rawls's point is actually a sound one, but it's not one that enables him to say that supervenience is incapable of rendering the debate. First of all, because Rosen's point leaves entirely untouched super difference. So even if you make this further assumption, you will still keep the supervenience difference between the two views that we saw before. Secondly, it does not enable him to say that grounding is the needed notion, because grounding is amenable to a similar kind of worry to the one that Rosen himself tries to establish with respect to supervenience. And we can see this by running a parallel argument to the one he gives in the following way. So I assume that LFP, so LP prime, is the view that the legal facts are grounded in social facts, and AP prime is the view that the legal facts are grounded in the social and the moral. Now add the counterpart to Greenberg's assumption to the effect that the moral is grounded in social broadly construed, then you have two options. Now, by the transitivity of grounding, you're gonna either have to say that according to both views, the legal facts are partly grounded in the social facts broadly construed, or you're gonna have to say that according to both views, by the transitivity of grounding, the legal facts are wholly grounded in the social facts broadly construed and something else. Now, this difference comes from the fact that while in the supervenience case we could move from the assumption that that basically there is a supervenience relation between a set and their supersets. In this case, we cannot do the same with grounding. So we cannot establish that from the fact that social facts are a subset of the social facts broadly construed, you cannot infer automatically that the former are grounded in the latter. But still, it's quite plausible to think that a subset is grounded in its superset plus something else. And so the superset, which is a superset of it, will be a partial ground for it. And so it's going to be a partial ground for that which is grounded in it itself. So Rosen fails in this respect. Now, so the conclusion that I want to try to derive from these remarks is, first of all, that supervenience has not been subjected to powerful criticism as far as super difference is concerned. So neither of the arguments that we consider actually succeeds in claiming that super difference is not the case. But I also want to say something more favorable to grounding. So actually, the role that grounding can play in debate is of a certain kind. So it can, for instance, allow for a further difference than the one that we saw with supervenience. And that's has to do with the first point. So whereas we saw that according to supervenience, one entails two, if we understand the debate in terms of grounding, that's not going to be the case anymore. This is due to a specific feature of grounding, namely its non-monotonicity. So while we derived that entailment in the case of supervenience by relying on the fact that you can arbitrarily enlarge a supervenience space and keep the truth of a supervenience claim, in the case of grounding, you cannot do that. So if you start from the true claim that A is grounded in B, you cannot, you're not justified in deriving the consequence that A is grounded in B and C for an arbitrary C. So enlarging the grounds, the set of grounds, does not guarantee you that the grounding relation is gonna hold still. And that's a formal property of grounding. Actually, this is not an uncontroversial one. So some people claim that grounding is monotonic as well. And to the extent that this property can be used to make sense of a difference between these two parties to the dispute, I think the debate on the nature of law provides the defenders of the non-monotonicity of grounding with a further consideration in their favor. So it can be used in favor of those who think that grounding is non-monotonic. So in the end, I wanted to illustrate how the debate between positivism and anti-positivism can be considered, at least in one legitimate sense of the term metaphysics, as being part of metaphysics. And I try to see whether, and I try to scrutinize whether it being part of metaphysics, it is also part of, it is also using the notion of supervenience or rather grounding. And I wanted to show that actually supervenience does allow some difference, does make room for some difference between the two views, and that grounding as well can make room for the debate, and also highlight some other differences between the two views. So we can discuss about that now.
Thank you.